Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Well, Donald Trump's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey continues to receive 24/7 media coverage. So we're going to dive right in and talk about how we got here and talk about the real story, what really matters. Joining us is Scott Horton, a lecturer at Columbia Law School and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Scott is the author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, and what a week.
Wow, what a week. Before we dive in and talk about media coverage of Comey, and maybe you're going to point to a story about Comey, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight good journalism this week. So what did you see, Scott?
Well, I picked out two things. One of them deals with the health crisis in the United States, a particularly acute one going on down in the Black Belt of Alabama, where there is an enormous tuberculosis outbreak that's getting actually very little attention and which results from the failure of the state's health care services to reach into the poorer parts of the state. And on this, there's an excellent essay by Helen Leung in the current issue of Harper's. And then on the current controversy we're talking about with Comey, I pick out Shane Harris's Wall Street Journal piece from Wednesday night, a very late Wednesday night, which I think succeeded in nailing the nugget almost everybody in Washington was looking for, which is that Comey, at the time he was fired, was getting weekly updates on the Russia investigation and, according to their sources, was particularly concerned by mounting evidence that he was receiving concerning possible collusion between persons in the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence. And I think that's the very, very core of this current scandal and its current state.
And we've been reading a really great piece called I'm Not Sure It's an Attack on Democracy. It's in Current Affairs by Nathan Robinson. And we will put links to all of these articles at yourcallradio.org. And that is Scott Horton. He's a contributing editor at Harper's and a lecturer at Columbia Law School. Okay, Scott. Let's dive in here. Before we talk about the coverage and all of these moving parts, I mean, just this morning, I got two alerts from CNN about Donald Trump's latest tweets about James Comey, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, let's step back and talk about how we got here.
Well, I think, the bigger problem I think we've got, which you see in the manifestation of these tweets and other things, is this 24/7 obsession with one single subject. So right now, the firing of James Comey is driving everything off the front page and totally dominating coverage, and it's being prompted in a sensationalistic fashion as if it were a constitutional crisis. Maybe it is. But even if it were, there's plenty of other news out there.
Mm-hmm.
Even understanding the crisis in a more serious way, what is this about? Is it just mistakes that James Comey has made as FBI director and managing Hillary's emails? That's the excuse originally proffered. Or is it something deeper? And I think here, at this point, there's simply no getting around the conclusion that this is all about the Russia investigation. And there's also no escaping the conclusion that that investigation is looming heavily over this entire administration. It's obviously something that is seen as an existential threat by Donald Trump personally and by many of the people around him. So I think all this occasions a need to go back and understand that whole issue, all the issues surrounding Trump and Russia, and that is ultimately far more important than the firing of an individual civil servant. So in a sense, it's a lot like the dismissal of Archibald Cox by Nixon. Cox, great man and all that, but the big question, of course, was Watergate.
Right. The New York Times reports that days before the firing, James Comey asked for more resources for the Russia inquiry from the Department of Justice. also asked for other personnel to accelerate the Bureau's investigation into Russia's interference in the presidential election. They report that two separate congressional inquiries into Russian meddling are relying on evidence and intelligence amassed by the FBI. And if the Bureau's investigation falters, the congressional inquiries are likely to be hobbled. So, but what about these reports that Comey was actually asking for more resources for this Russia inquiry just days before he was fired?
I think there's no question about it. That's correct. And I had some involvement in that in the background, too, having spoken with some of the congressional figures who were working on this about the resources that were needed. And I think it was really quite obvious that either they were going to have to ratchet up quite dramatically the scale of their own staffing and expenditures to do it, to do this work, or they were going to have to rely on the FBI and ensure that the FBI met all of their immediate needs for, you know, detail on forensics, analysis of hacks and other things. And I think there have been a series of discussions between the heads of these committees, that is both the ranking members and the chairs of the intelligence committees, House and Senate, and Comey, in which they impressed with him very aggressively the case for the FBI to step into the gap and to provide all these resources. And that was the source of Comey's request then to the Justice Department. And now if we nail down the process of his being fired, it links up exactly. So there seems to be just no doubt that it's his pressing to expand the inquiry, to add more agents and more resources to it, that is the ultimate trigger for the decision to fire him. They line up just in terms of time perfectly. So I think there's just no escaping that fact.
Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, will be with us until about 30 after the hour. And I know that a lot of you would like to weigh in on this. So I want to give out the phone number now. Since this issue is getting 24/7 media coverage, what are your thoughts on the coverage? And what we really want to do in this section is connect all of the dots, because we seem to be getting pieces, breaking news, tweets. But let's connect the dots and figure out what is actually going on. What's most important about this story? What are your thoughts on the coverage that you have read and heard so far? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And what do you think of all of the talk about parallels to Watergate? People are writing about CNN because they're having between 9 and 11 talking heads on the screen at any given time, and they're all making connections to Watergate. So what are your thoughts about that? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So trying to put the pieces together, Scott, the other interesting piece of news is NBC reports that Trump hired a Washington law firm to send a letter to Lindsey Graham, member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, to say that he has no connections to Russia. And Trump also talked about this, saying he hired this big law firm to send this letter. He was on a TV interview recently. What about this part of the story? How odd is this for the person in the White House to hire a law firm to send a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Well, I've now read that letter. It comes from the law firm of Morgan Lewis. Actually, it's a Philadelphia-based law firm, but it's the Washington office of the firm that's doing this. And that's the law firm which for years has done his tax returns. And their letter, of course, is very, very carefully drawn, and it says that there is no information in the tax returns that they have and they've prepared that shows links to Russia, with the exception of about $100 million he received in 2006-2007 from Mr. Rublyovyev, the so-called potash king of Russia. I guess in part the quick response is going to be, well, if you have nothing to worry about, why don't you actually release those returns so that they can be examined? And I think what we're going to see is that the money that is coming from Russian sources, which other journalists have already pulled out. I mean, we've had extensive reporting in the Financial Times, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and other places delving with this, which actually has shown a very substantial flow of cash from Russian sources into Trump's pocket. What we see is all this is being filtered through offshore entities in the Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands, and so forth, which puts lawyers in a position to say, that's from a Cayman Islands company. It's not from a Russian company. And, of course, lawyers making such assurances know only what they know and what they choose to know. So it's not that Morgan Lewis has conducted any independent investigation or inquiry into the subject. They disclaim that. So I'd say the letter that was sent, which Trump consistently insisted was a certified letter. Yes, he means certified in that they paid to have the post office collect a signature on its delivery. It has nothing to do with certification in any other sense. In the end, it really counts for almost nothing.
Public Citizen put out a release after all this happened, and Public Citizen says that we need a special prosecutor and a congressionally created, fully funded, and independent investigative commission to get to the bottom of what, if anything, has happened. They also say there should be an investigation into the firing itself. In this circumstance, the FBI should be directed immediately to disclose all ongoing criminal investigations related to the Trump campaign and the administration. What are your thoughts on that?
It's exactly right. And, of course, we've had a number of members of Congress, including Republicans, make exactly the same observation. And let's take the second point first. This was a crisis event, terminating the director of the FBI in these circumstances. The law assumes that the director of the FBI serves a staggered 10-year term. So going past the administration of the president who appoints him, and that's done so as to insulate him from exactly this sort of politically motivated termination. And Congress, if it's doing its job, then has to, whatever ultimately they conclude, they have to engage in a special inquiry into the circumstances of this termination. That would be essential. And I think that means bringing Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein before Congress under oath to explain the circumstances of what happened. We have huge questions there. We have, for instance, Jeff Sessions having agreed to recuse himself from everything relating to the Russia investigation and nevertheless involving himself in the central role here. So that provides plenty of questions. We have representations being made by the White House about the role that Rod Rosenstein played, which then are immediately denied by people close to Rod Rosenstein at the Department of Justice. And we also have Trump's own statements and the interview he gave Les Holt, the tweets he sent this morning in which he discusses conversations he had with Comey, which are eyebrow-raising. They're the sorts of things that could easily be characterized as obstruction of justice. And this morning he's suggesting that he may have made tapes of these things. So I would say Congress would be within its rights demanding that any tapes that are made be turned over so that they can be listened to as a part of the examination.
This tweet from Donald Trump said, quote, James Comey better hope that there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press. He also wrote, as a very active president with lots of things happening, it's not possible for my surrogates to stand at a podium with perfect accuracy, exclamation point. Maybe the best thing to do would be to cancel all future press briefings and hand out written responses for the sake of accuracy, followed by 3 question marks. These are tweets from Donald Trump this morning, Scott.
No, it sounds like the script for a Saturday Night Live skit coming in a couple of days. It's absolutely amazing stuff. And it's consequential. So I would say, you know, a lawyer for Donald Trump would have told him, don't publish that tweet. That's very damaging to you. So he made statements, and he suggested the existence potentially of tapes. He described in detail his conversations with the director of the FBI. Now, look, a meeting in the White House between the director of the FBI and the president would be assumed to be subject to presidential privilege. That is, you know, people wouldn't be able to pry into and learn what was heard and said. It would be secret. Not, however, when the president goes out and makes statements about it and issues tweets. That would be viewed as a waiver of executive privilege. And this brings us back to another almost perfect parallel to Watergate, because remember we had the Rosemary Wood tapes that were made at one point. And we had disclosure and statements about those tapes that resulted in waiver of executive privilege in that case and resulted ultimately in court orders for their disclosure. And that's one of the things that precipitated the downfall of the Nixon presidency, led very, very quickly to his resignation.
Scott Horton is a lecturer at Columbia Law School and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. He's the author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite, and America's Stealth Warfare. Scott is joining today's media roundtable to talk about Donald Trump's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey. It's receiving 24/7 media coverage. What do you think of the coverage? What is the real story here? We're going to try to put the basically connect the dots and figure out what's really going on. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Scott will be with us for about 9 more minutes. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Scott, what about this comparison with Watergate? The Washington Post is reporting one story quoted 30 different sources, and they're reporting that Republicans do not want an independent commission because they can't control it, and then they might have a Watergate situation on their hands. What do you think about that?
I think that's exactly right. So, I think the demands have been growing. They've attempted to stifle the inquiry repeatedly. That was the background to the whole business involving Mr. Nunez, and that's not gone well. That's caused the public to suspect more and more that there's an effort here to cover things up, and so we've seen in public opinion polling demands for an independent inquiry and potentially a special prosecutor go from 40 to 50 to 60 to now 70, now to 71%, and that's before the firing of James Comey. So, pressure for this is coming hard. And what I suspect is going to happen is when Rod Rosenstein comes before Congress to testify, he's going to be put under immense pressure to make the decision now on a special prosecutor and to put forward a name that that congressional Democrats can be comfortable with. I think that's what we're headed for. I think that's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. I think there will be strong resistance against it from the Republicans, but their position has been so weakened by the way Trump has managed this that I'm not sure they'll be able to resist it.
Will Bunch, a reporter with the Philadelphia Daily News, is tweeting that CNN's Jeff Zeleny is reporting that James Comey's office is cordoned off with yellow crime scene tape. And Will says you can't make this stuff up.
That's crazy. But there were reports right at the time of his firing that the White House had waited for him to depart to Los Angeles before firing him so that they could seal off and seize things from his office, and that they were particularly concerned to get the evidence that Comey had and he had seen from the Russia inquiry, particularly including exactly the materials Shane Harris had reported on, that he had seen evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence officers.
Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and you can join us at 866-798-8255. Scott will be with us for about 5 more minutes to talk about media coverage of the firing of FBI Director James Comey and what's the real story here. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thanks for calling.
Just a couple of comments for Scott. One, in somewhat of an ironic or cynical view, if grandstanding and showboating is now the requiem for dismissal, can we run that up the flagpole a little higher? And second of all, I just, in musing, was thinking if I were a foreign power, I wanted to contribute to the demise of the United States around the world, what would be my game plan? Would it be pulling out of trade agreements? Would it be disrupting the power structure a la firing the head of the greatest, the most important investigative body, closing the borders? What would be all the facets of the game plan to just reduce the overall impact or influence of the U.S. and world today?
Well, I'd say the second point is really, I mean, the first, this is a classic case, of course, of the pot calling the kettle black. But the second point's really much more important. And on that, you know, we know the Russian strategic plan. You know, it was put together by Valery Gerasimov, the head strategic planner for the Russian General Staff. And it spells out in some detail the tactics they plan to use against the NATO allies. And all the things you just mentioned are right at the top of the list of the things they intend to do. So they want to work very hard to fragment the NATO alliance, to undermine ties between the United States and its key trading partners and allies. They want to damage NATO itself. They'd like to see nations leave NATO. They want to damage the European Union and break that apart. They want to foment and support secessionist movements in all these countries. In fact, we see all that going on as well. And trade war, of course, is another perfect way of achieving all these things. So is there an alignment between those plans and the things that Donald Trump is doing? Yes, there's an absolutely perfect alignment between them. And I think it's just amazing that on the day following the firing of James Comey, Donald Trump had exactly one important meeting that day, and that was with the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador, and they had a session together, very convivial, jovial, laughing, back-slapping session in the Oval Office, accompanied only by media from TASS, the Russian state news agency. No American media were allowed in to cover it. I mean, all this is just, you can't make this stuff up. It's crazy.
And photos were released from that meeting taken by a Russian photographer. As you said, no American press attended. How surprising was this to you, Scott, that not only that they met so closely to the firing, but that there were no American media in the room, just Russian?
It breaches all normal protocol. And it shows, I'd say at one level, it shows extraordinary deference being given to the Russians, and it shows a back of the hand to the American media. And I think there are other things that have happened. I mean, we have some reports out of the Middle East today concerning developments in Syria and Libya, which are being widely interpreted locally as an American tilt to support Russian positions in both of those countries. Of course, that's one of the things we're looking for. What materially is going to emerge from this new relationship with Russia, and will it result in the U.S. unilaterally changing its position and embracing the Russian position? And if so, what is the U.S. getting from all of this?
Scott, we have about a minute left. At this point, what questions should reporters be asking, and where do you think the story's going?
Well, I think there's got to be a really doubling down on the core questions surrounding the Russia probe itself. And what I see right now, and I'm told by people who are very well informed, that this is what was going on in the FBI probe. It's switching from a review just of the emails and the email hacks to a tracing of money that was flowing from Russian sources to Trump and his organization over the period starting in 2006. I think that was going on. I think there was an FBI forensic team that was launching into that in a big way. That's what caused Lindsey Graham to say what he said. And I think they've come up with some pretty big things.
And just quickly, Scott, Donald Trump tweeted a photo with the Russians, and under the photo it said, "Let's make peace."
Yeah, that is what he says. In fact, it was a rather elaborate photo with all sorts of graphics added into it, too. Just amazing. And I think we're going to see this is the grand vision, the grand gesture, which Steve Bannon was advocating for a long time, which was a resolution of Syria, a resolution of Ukraine. But the resolution is, I think we've seen, on terms which are almost entirely dictated by the Kremlin.
You know, Scott, we're getting a lot of phone calls. Would you mind sticking with us for a couple more minutes?
Happy to do it.
Okay, thank you. Scott Horton is a lecturer at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, general manager of KALW, here in the studio with Malihe Razazan, senior producer of Your Call, taking 2 minutes from the Media Roundtable, one of those times in the week I know many people tune to KALW to hear Rose and her guests talk about coverage of major stories of the week. If you appreciate the voices you hear on this program, the perspective you hear from the people who know how to do good reporting, your support now will make a big difference. The number to call, 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
1-800-525-9917, KALW.org. 1-800-525-9917, KALW.org. That's where you can go and support brave, bold, independent, national, local, international journalism. 1-800-525-9917.
As we are aiming to wrap up this campaign tomorrow, we have a lot of big challenges ahead. And one of them is in this hour. A group of listeners, David Kerp in San Francisco, Diane McKenna in Sunnyvale, and Stefan Grunwedel in San Francisco, have put forward $2,000. And they've said if 30 people support KALW during this Your Call, they will give that additional $2,000 to local public radio. This is our biggest challenge during Your Call. And in this hour, Media Roundtable, a listener favorite, we want to hear from you.
And this is the time that good journalism, bold journalism, can decide the direction of this country. 1-800-525-9917, KALW.org.
800-525-9917, 800-525-9917. Every call, every click at every level makes a difference right now. We're going to go back to Rose and her guest. As you listen, give your support.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we're joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Scott's going to stick with us for a bit longer because we have a lot of interest, not surprisingly, in this story about Donald Trump firing FBI Director James Comey. And what we wanted to do is take a step back and talk about how we got here and what are the most important aspects of this story. How can we connect the dots? If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have two quick things. One is yesterday we heard Comey seemingly go absolutely belly up and say that the president had the right to fire him for any reason or for no reason. And we thought, is he being blackmailed? And lo and behold, today Trump tweets that Comey better worry about tapes that Trump has before he goes to the press. So I thought that was really telling that he had made those comments yesterday and, you know, is maybe running scared. And the other quick question that I have is, how can the Justice Department be expected to appoint a special prosecutor that is independent and fair when they are really just an extension of Trump, and Sessions, in fact, is supposed to be recused? So those are my two things.
Yeah, important question. Thank you, Kathleen. What about the second question, Scott? What could we expect from an independent investigation under this administration?
Well, you know, the independent counsel law has expired, so we don't have that whole machinery for appointing an independent counsel. What we have now in light of the recusal of Jeff Sessions is a Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, who has the authority and power to appoint an independent prosecutor to handle the matter and to set the terms on which any ultimate review and decision can be taken by him. And I think that's, you know, this is the technique that's existed historically, and it can work just fine. So Rod Rosenstein can tap and appoint a retired former prosecutor, a prominent federal judge, a retired judge, or an existing prosecutor who is a person of well-known integrity and discretion, and put them in charge of the investigation. And I think that's what needs to happen right now. I think we're at the point now where the public interest really calls for the appointment of such a person, and it needs to be a person of stature. That is, a person whose reputation and stature make him the peer or the superior of Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein. And there are plenty of such people in the country.
Well, we're going to definitely continue to cover this, and we'd love to have you back, Scott. Thank you for joining us and connecting the dots, because there's a lot of noise out there.
It's my great pleasure.
Thank you. Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of the book Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And you can find Scott's work at yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Michael Grable to join us. Michael covers economic issues, labor, immigration, and trade for ProPublica. He has reported on the ground from more than 30 states and from some of the most remote villages in Alaska and also in Guatemala. And Michael has an incredible piece out about immigrants who are fleeing violence and poverty from countries like Guatemala, and then they end up being exploited by meatpacking companies like Case Farms here in the United States. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you. This story you have about immigrants fleeing poverty and violence from companies like Guatemala and then ending up being exploited by U.S. companies, I mean, it's horrific, but really incredible reporting. Can you talk about, first off, you've been covering these issues for a long time. How is this story really changing under Donald Trump?
So the way it's changed, I mean, on this story specifically, when I started out, people's tones kind of changed a bit. I mean, people were more open and willing to talk to me at the beginning of my reporting than at the end of the reporting. And you hear this more and more of workers being fearful to bring cases forward, to talk about their injuries going forward, and that companies are kind of using the Trump administration, the immigration policies, as a way to prevent workers from speaking out. We have both an enforcement that is focusing on individual immigrants at the same time as we are having kind of a rollback of labor regulations.
You focused on Case Farms, which is a chicken plant in Akron. Is it Akron? Yeah, Akron, Ohio. Why did you decide to focus on Case Farms?
So I have been covering economic and labor issues, as you mentioned, for about 5 years, and I kept hearing about stories of companies using immigration status to retaliate against workers. So I actually set out to speak to as many people as I could, and I interviewed about 150 attorneys, immigrant advocates, people who study migration on both sides of the border. And one thing I actually heard from a California attorney is that every time he goes back to his hometown in Mexico, the only people that are left are women with small children, the elderly, and America's injured workers. So I spoke to some people about this, and they said, you know, well, there's this chicken plant in Ohio that employs a lot of people from Aguacatan, a town in Guatemala. And when I heard that, I said, wait a minute, I've heard of this town before. And I looked through my notes and found out that I had interviewed someone else about a chicken plant in North Carolina that employs a lot of people from Aguacatan, and it turned out they both were Case Farms. And I looked through my notes and realized I had three more tips about Case Farms in relation to either immigration retaliation or safety in the workplace and things like that.
And before we talk about the specifics and what you found when you traveled to these villages in Guatemala, in your piece, you report that U.S. companies subvert immigration laws to take advantage of undocumented immigrants. Also, when you look at the truth about the American economy, so much of it depends on a never-ending global scramble for low-skilled labor. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, so if you think back to the jungle. Jurgis Rutkus, the hero, is fresh off the boat, immigrant from Lithuania. So this has been going on really since the founding of the U.S., where there's been a global scramble for jobs that are very difficult to do. For a short period of time, you know, meatpacking plants did actually employ people at decent wages, but they set out to recruit immigrants, and more recently we have seen a lot of refugees, Somali workers in towns in Kansas. Talk about in the piece about Springdale, Arkansas, which has a huge population of people from the Marshall Islands who have some special immigration status because of the nuclear testing that went on during the Cold War. And at Case Farms, the plant I focused on, which had long employed the Mayan workers, now has recruited a lot of workers from Bhutan.
How does that work when they recruit workers? A chicken plant in Akron, Ohio, how do they go about recruiting workers from Bhutan?
So they, so let's start first with the Guatemalan workers who came there. One night in 1989, so Case Farms, a lot of other meatpacking plants, were having a lot of trouble employing people who wanted to work in these conditions that were that they created, and they set out to, at this time, to hire a lot of Hispanics. So meatpacking plants and poultry plants were recruiting in Florida in these farm labor towns. One night in 1989, Case Farms sent a human resources manager to a place called Indiantown, Florida, where a lot of Guatemalan workers had, or Guatemalan people had fled the Guatemalan Civil War. It was a very desperate situation, and they were very willing to go work at the chicken plant in Morganton, North Carolina, where this plant, that specific plant was. Now, with the Bhutanese workers, they a lot of people from Bhutan have resettled in the U.S. in Akron, Ohio. That has been kind of the, one of the main destinations. And Case Farms somehow tapped into some of the refugee resettlement agencies, offering them this work. Case Farms is desperate for workers. The workers, in turn, are desperate for work where they don't have to speak English and don't have to have a U.S. education to perform it.
One of the other key points in your piece, you report that as the Mayan workers gained strength, eventually unionizing and going on strike, the company recruited a series of immigrant groups, Cubans, Romanians, Chinese, North Africans, Burmese, seemingly pitting immigrant communities against each other.
Yeah, there's this one instance, and this is kind of agreed upon by the National Labor Relations Board, but there's one instance where a worker testified before this board and said that the human resources manager had told them that they would give everybody a dollar an hour raise if they can get the newcomers to sign papers to get rid of the union, which was led by the Guatemalan workers at the time. And so these newcomers were all from Burma. They were Burmese refugees. And they went in, and the translator told them, we're going to see how the work is, and after we see how the workers, then we'll decide whether we want to support the union or not. And they waited for that translator left, and then spoke to a woman who barely spoke English, and they told her the deal, essentially, and she said, oh, more money, and she said, yes, more money. And so she says everyone then signed little papers to get rid of the union.
I've never heard of Case Farms Chicken. Can you tell us more about this company?
Yeah, so Case Farms is a major supplier for fast food restaurants and supermarkets. They don't sell under their own brand, but they do supply to Kentucky Fried Chicken, to Popeyes, Taco Bell. Boar's Head sells its chicken as deli meat in supermarkets. And even the U.S. government is a customer of theirs. They have spent $17 million in recent years to buy chicken for the federal school lunch program.
Who owns Case Farms?
Case Farms is owned, or at least was started, by a man named Tom Shelton, who is a former president of Purdue Chicken. He kind of developed this reputation of buying up small chicken plants, small family-owned chicken plants, and incorporating the ideas he had learned at Purdue about efficiency to make plants, as efficient as possible.
The company did respond to your report, and it said that in 2016, its chicken catchers, that's what they call them, chicken catchers, made about $65,000 a year. While Case Farms may employ some of its own catchers, the company's statement leaves out the fact that it contracts out much of its chicken catching, and this is according to ProPublica. Workers told ProPublica they are paid $2.25 for every 1,000 chickens, and as a crew, they catch 75,000 chickens a night. 75,000 a night.
Yeah, this is probably one of the hardest jobs in America. These are the workers who go to the barns, really the chicken houses, of contracted farmers, and they will go get the chicken to put on into the cages so they can go into the trucks and be shipped to the plant. If anyone has seen a truck driving along the road with lots of chickens in it, this is how it happens. The workers go in late at night when the chickens are sleeping and calmer, and they grab 4 chickens in each hand, is what they tell me. And the chickens are, flapping and scratching, in some cases going to the bathroom on the workers, and the workers work very fast to get the chickens into the cages. So that's how they catch these 75,000 chickens a night. Now, what workers told me, the wage they make, so the math turns out, it's very hard work to get the wage, but it turns out it's better than what the people inside the plant make, who are making minimum wage. But at the same time, you don't get overtime. You pay, you're an independent contractor, so you have the taxes in addition to that. But workers who are willing to work hard say they like that, you know, they prefer this job because it pays much higher than actually the line work at a chicken plant.
This is obviously horrific for the chicken and horrific for the worker. You report that Case Farm plants are among the most dangerous workplaces in the U.S. In 2015 alone, federal workplace safety inspectors fined the company $2 million, and in the past 7 years, it's been cited for 240 violations. That is more than any other company in poultry except for Tyson Foods, which has more than 30 times as many employees. Can you tell us about some of the people that you interviewed? One person lost a leg. I mean, there's so many horrific accidents that happen in these plants.
Yeah, there was a worker that I profiled. His name is Ociel Lopez Perez, and he started working at the chicken plant at when he was 16 years old, child laborer under the law. He had gotten the job with a fake ID that said he was 28 years old, which he looked nothing like. He didn't look anything like the ID, the picture on the ID. And he was working for a sanitation crew, a sanitation contractor for the company. And one night, he's cleaning what's known as a liver giblet chiller, and he goes. There's not enough ladders to go around. So he climbs up the machine, as he said a supervisor had shown him, to turn off the water valve. And as he does this, his foot slips, and the machine automatically kicks on and essentially mangles his leg, you know, literally tears off his leg in the machine. So here's a 17-year-old kid now whose life is totally affected by this. He was an unaccompanied minor fleeing gang violence after his mother was shot in Guatemala. And, you know, other workers, I spoke to a lot of workers who lost fingers at the plant. Of course, the pain in the hands from cutting chickens, 45 chickens a minute, the workers tell me, developed it over several years. You know, women with carpal tunnel, years later, still feeling the pain in their hands, difficult to use them.
And what happens when workers are hurt on the job in these meatpacking plants?
So what's supposed to happen is that no matter what, regardless of their immigration status, they are entitled, based on employment, they are entitled to compensation for their injuries, for medical care, paid for by the company or their insurer. So that is working out for OCL. What happens oftentimes, though, is workers fear their immigration status, that if they get into some sort of public system, that they will be targeted and detained. And this is again, back during the Obama administration, there was an agreement between ICE and the Department of Labor that they would not investigate workers, they would not raid plants while there was a labor dispute going on. That, I'm told, still exists under the Trump administration right now, but there's a lot of fear that the Trump administration, given the signs it has shown, the signs that it has shown so far, may scrap that and embolden employers to simply call ICE anytime workers complain, which is something we've seen a lot in the past.
Today we're speaking with Michael Grable, who is a reporter with ProPublica, and he's got an extensive report out that I hope you can read maybe over the weekend. It's very long. It's called Sold for Parts. One of the most dangerous companies in the U.S. took advantage of immigrant workers. Then, when they got hurt or fought back, it used America's laws against them. And if you have any questions or comments for Michael about the extensive reporting he's done on this issue, obviously directly connected to immigration and what's happening right now in the U.S., you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. In the piece, Michael, you write that you contacted 60 former Case Farm managers, supervisors, and human resource representatives, and most declined to comment or didn't return your calls, but you did speak with 8 of them, and you learned that human resources supervisors sold fake identification cards.
Yeah, this is something I heard a lot from employees, that whenever something would happen, that there was sort of this unwritten policy that you could if you got a no-match letter that the Social Security Administration used to send out saying that your Social Security number wasn't good, that you could just return with another ID. I spoke to one worker who has worked at a plant in North Carolina for Case Farms under 4 different names, he told me. And and one worker I spoke to, her name was Avodia Gonzalez-Dimas, that she was told that her ID wasn't good, and came back the same day with a new ID, and a new name, and nobody asked her any questions. And she tells me that she was actually, you know, sold the ID for $500 by the human resources supervisor. Case Farms, when I interviewed the managers, they said they acknowledged, yes, we have had people sell IDs. We have had human resources people that we suspected were selling IDs, and when we found out the evidence, we fired them. So there's some knowledge that this was happening.
Let's hear from a listener. Let's go to Joe in Oakland. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just basically have been listening to this.
Sorry, Joe. Can you speak up? We have a bad line. Joe?
I said thank you for accepting my call. I've been listening to this for the last 10, 15 minutes. But this is basically, it's the same issue what's happening right now with Uber. You have a lot of drivers, they are stuck. They are literally stuck, feeling that they have to do the job because they are stuck with car payment, they have family to take care of, but at the same time, they are investing their time and their cars and their and whatever, and they are just being paid dollar for, it doesn't even worth it.
Well, Joe, thank you. We've done shows about that. What about the larger question here, Michael? What do you think about reporting overall about these dangerous jobs, jobs that do not pay enough for a living wage, people who have two or three jobs? Just what do you think about that kind of reporting overall?
Yeah, this is another story that I did in the past, was on the growth of temporary and contingent work in the economy. This people call this the gig economy, but at the same time, it's been going on in the larger economy for a much longer period of time. There's even one study that showed that, since 2007, all of the job growth has occurred in these sectors, these very shaky part-time work, contract work, gig economy work. And it's really tough out there to make have a stable living.
Michael, thank you for calling in, Joe. We're going to continue covering those issues. Michael, you travel to Guatemala to meet some of the workers who worked in these poultry plants and then went back home. And you have just some really amazing photos. I just so appreciate that you gave people a voice. What are you hoping comes from this report? What kind of response have you received?
Two things that I'm hearing from people. I mean, one is that the piece shows how some of the faults with our current immigration law. This was we're working under an immigration law from 1986 that basically made it extremely difficult for the government to go after employers who hire undocumented immigrants, but at the same time made it very easy for employers to turn around and retaliate against those immigrant workers because of the way the law is written. Now, the second thing that I've heard, traveling to Guatemala, is you notice, how horrific the conditions that they were fleeing during the civil. We call it, the Guatemalan Civil War, but this was really a series of massacres committed by the Guatemalan military that was over the years supported with money, weapons, intelligence, and training by the U.S. government. Now, when those people fled and sought refuge in the U.S., a lot of them were turned away. They were denied asylum. And their children, who kind of grew up in these villages as toddlers without parents, then come to the U.S. And how do they fit into this refugee picture? Mm. So the U.S. has really never kind of accounted for, what do you do with these people that the U.S. is very involved in causing that immigration to occur?
And the last paragraph and the last photo is pretty incredible. Guatemalans make up the second largest group of unauthorized immigrants in the U.S., the largest group of unaccompanied children who have crossed the border in recent years, and many towns have built statues of migrants, complete with backpacks, ball caps, and water jugs to pay homage to those who've left. And then that's the last photo in your piece, Michael. Pretty powerful.
Yeah. These photos were taken by Hector Emmanuel, a fantastic photographer. And we saw this just driving through some of the mountain villages of Huehuetenango, these statues of young, what looked like young boys, traveling with water jugs and backpacks, really symbolizing the migration that has occurred.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your incredible reporting, and keep it up. We'd love to have you back. You do great reporting. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You can find Michael's pieces, Sold for Parts and Returning to the Roots of Case Farms Workforce, at yourcallradio.org. That's Michael Grable with ProPublica. And I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call, and thank you for joining us.